This month, the subject is shame. Yeah, the bad word. It could very well be one of the most avoided words in the English language, and no wonder. It seems dark and sticky and secretive by its very nature, and leaves us with the lurking notion that if all the things we're embarrassed about were exposed, we would surely be rejected. Whether the source of this self-hatred is from abuse, the subject of sex, things that we've done that we feel weird about, or just being in a human body, shame can wind its way into the story of our lives.
Because the shame, the feeling, because you feel it physically, you feel it emotionally, it's linked to the story, but it's what embodies the story. So then to meet that, you see it has no substance. That's the liberation. It's not like you get liberated from it. It's actually liberated from you.
Who wants to talk about shame for 30 minutes? Well, it looks like we do, and we hope you'll join us. We're going to look this monster called shame right in the eye. I'm Hillary Larson, and this is A Conversation with Conga G.
Well, I'm curious what the topic is.
I was just going to say, I usually don't start the recorder. You'll sit down and ask me, but this time I started the recorder because, like, truly, you don't know what the topic is. So the title of this topic is called The Secret Life of Shame.
Oh, shame.
Yeah.
Well, it would have to be secret. But it leaks.
Oh, God. You know, just when you think you're over shame, then the topic of shame comes up.
Mm.
So this was actually pretty interesting to me because we've got topics, secret topics, lined up for the future. And next month we are doing the Courage to Give Up Hope.
Mm.
And I was really excited about that and been really looking at that topic. And I was really ignoring this next show, the one we were doing actually even before that. And I realized that once again, I actually do not like the word shame.
Mm-hmm.
These days, I don't feel shame that much, but there's something that just is so, it's like the horrible stepchild of all emotions to me.
Yeah, it's a form of control, and it's been used to control us in different ways, and we've internalized it as slaves do to their masters of control. And, you know, in one sense, we have a lot to be ashamed of. As a species and as individuals, we've all done things that were less than noble at the very best. And so in that sense, the regret, if we can make a distinction between really recognizing the regret and how ignorant we were at certain times, maybe especially when we thought we knew exactly what was going on, and the harm we've caused, the hurt we've caused, then I think shame isn't a tool for control. It really becomes an honest regret, and it's a way of deepening and humbling. And that's the idea behind shame, is to humble, but there's such a yoke to it that it's real punishment. And then it also becomes a habit.
When I look at shame from a positive point of view, I think that it's kind of like this innate early warning system that we have within ourselves that it's like, oh, something's wrong. Something's off here. But I think what happens is there's a situation, it brings up the feeling of shame. And then there's a decision made about what we're experiencing in this moment. And the decision could be, I'm a bad person because this is happening.
But does shame have to do with the moment, or is it something, it's about something in the past?
Well, that's a good point.
I don't think it's something that is happening. You may be bringing some feeling from the past that's triggered by something in the moment, but shame, like guilt, is made up. It has to have a story that goes with it. And in the moment, there is no story.
When I think of particular kinds of shame,
mm-hmm.
like shame that happens within the context of sexual abuse or physical abuse, there's a certain amount of humiliation that goes with that kind
from
of abuse.
From the abuser or the one abused or both.
I think it can be both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so then if you're speaking of that, of course, that's huge. And often people who are abused actually feel shame, feel somehow responsible that they brought it on or whatever. So if there's something that triggers that, a sexual encounter or whatever, then that can be reactivated. But I still don't get how it's has anything to do with what's actually happening. Shame or regret, because it's they're both about looking back and then being so humiliated or so horrified at what one allowed to happen, because that's usually the part of the victim is thinking somehow I allowed this or invited this, and society can support that too, of course. So it can get very complicated, but I think it's best if we try to simplify the complication so that we can see what is it really about? What's under the shame? What is the shame a reflection of?
Remember when we did this show, I think it was called, it was a couple years ago, we did a show called Sex, Truth, and Desire. And in that I was telling you that in my family we didn't talk about sex or bodies much. So there was a way that I got this idea that sex was bad. Mm-hmm. And it was probably, you know, like a lineage thing, right? And so in a way, I kind of like tried to skirt shame by having a lot of sex. And so it would make me feel like I was in control of the shame. See, like shame's not an issue for me. And that was my own very private war, frankly, that nobody mm-hmm. could see. And then when I was in my 40s, actually it happened right after I read Diamond in Your Pocket, is I was so sick of that shame ruling my relationships that I finally, because there were lots of evaluations made on my reaction, whether it was, you know, other things in my past that was causing it or whatever. But when it came down to it, it was just the feeling of shame. And when I let myself feel the shame, it was so amazing because it just blew right through me. And it changed my whole perspective and experience on intimate relationships, changed in a moment.
Yes, it wasn't in the bed with you. So when you're saying that, I mean, I hear shame as a version of self-hatred, some kind of proof that the hatred is deserved and yet dangerous. If we see how bad you really are, how wrong you really are, you know, you could be killed, you could be ostracized, you could be left behind. Because it always, if you're willing to trace it back, to deconstruct it, it always gets back to some form of survival. That's the badness of being wrong, or the badness of... And then we rebel against that, as you did with your family's culture of sex is wrong. But the rebellion is still actually in, the shame is in play. The wrongness is in play. And no rebellion is necessary unless you've already taken the bait.
And the thing about shame, too, is that if shame comes up and we don't like that feeling, because I think it's so visceral, that it shows up in my body in a very distinct way, then in order to distract myself from it, there's a break in intimacy I have to have within myself in order to ignore it. And then that moves to the outside because I'm hiding my secret from you.
It's interesting. I think probably people have different strategies for dealing with it. My experience with shame would be to sort of wallow in it, indulge in it, and then kind of wake up from that, but like a masochistic punishing myself. Not in those words, because the story is hidden under the feeling, the visceral, emotional feeling. So that's interesting. I think different people would relate to it differently, although I think most human beings can relate to the issue of shame.
Yeah, and actually I can totally relate to wallowing, because I did my fair share of wallowing in that. There was, you talk about entertainment. When I look back on it, there was some source of entertainment in that for me of like,
oh, I'm sick.
Yeah, I'm that sick, right?
There, that, what a beautiful response.
Sick like nobody else could possibly be. That's my secret.
Yeah, well, I, you know, it's interesting because I grew up in a household where my parents were sexual and we could feel that in the house, and they made noises in the bedroom and we could hear them. So it's not like sex was ever made to be wrong, or I ever heard that it was wrong. But still, I was in a bigger culture. I went to a Catholic school for a couple of years. And so when I had my first sexual feelings as a young child, just something, you know, stimulating me, I was horrified. I just assumed nobody in the world had ever had anything like that happen. And I must be the devil or the worst. So it's got to be some part of our society's control. And then it's even beyond what was going on in your household, because it's the bigger society. Usually the household reflects that to a big degree, but we grew up in really different kinds of household, and yet we both know shame very intimately, I'm sure.
I think that there's, when I listen to you talk, having said what I've said, I can still also say your experience is true for me too. And I think there's that, who knows how long our cellular memory is of religious rights and wrongs. So,
well, you know, you can look at dogs sometimes and they look like they're ashamed for what they've done. I mean, they say that we are projecting that onto them, but they also realize each decade more about animals of all kinds. I read today that manta rays, the fish manta rays, actually recognize their own self-reflection in a mirror. And that used to be the determinant of a conscious being when they saw that apes and monkeys did that. Not relating to it, but moving, you know, seeing that it is them. So if manta rays have thoughts and feelings, then how far from humans are they? I mean, we are animals, and maybe that's just some kind of universal teaching tool. Like dogs, bad dog. That, you know, the dog knows what that phrase means, and you can see the expression when, even before you've said the phrase, it knows it's coming. And so, in a sense, shame is sort of taking care of the society's job. So if I hate myself enough, society won't have to.
Yeah, that's it.
And
that's
let
it.
Me stay.
Yeah. Isn't it so much comes down to everything related to being in a body? You know, whether it's I have a lot of money, I don't have a lot of money, I eat too little food, I eat too much food, I've been abused, I've not been abused. It just seems like it goes on and on, but it's all about this identification of who I think I am.
And then the issue is, are we preoccupied with that? Because that's natural to some degree. But given our level of privilege and that we have survived to this moment, in this particular moment, we really don't have to be preoccupied with what I'm doing wrong or what I did wrong. We can actually just be here. And in that, we have the invitation to open to really what is free already and always, free of that delineation, of that judgment. It's not to say that certain behavior isn't right or wrong, but the consciousness that doesn't need to survive can recognize itself as free of that. But mostly we just get more and more preoccupied with it and obsessive. And we're living these lives of privilege and bounty. And we just then go back into the past to find something to hate ourselves about, or imagine a future where we aren't doing something the way we think we should be doing. And that's what's the unnecessary suffering that doesn't have anything to do with just the conditioning that's necessary to exist in a herd. It's what we add to it, this unnecessary suffering that we really have to stop if we are going to evolve as a species, because it keeps us looping back and into the lower realm of our lives as humans. And the invitation is to be fully, fully yourself.
Did you have a certain brand of shame that haunted you? And was there a point where you saw it for what it was?
I had a certain feeling, like you were saying, I knew it. And then there was a moment I can remember very clearly in my early 30s where I recognized that I was torturing myself, that something had happened and I was making myself wrong about it. And there was a way I was replaying it. And that's what I was talking about earlier, the masochistic part. I recognized that there was, as you said, an entertainment. It wasn't pleasurable, but there was some way it was. It didn't validate me, but it was a kind of pleasure and a kind of validation. It was like the deeper I could stick the knife and twist the knife. And then I just got it. This is what masochism means, is a kind of getting off on this torture. And that was a moment of choice. And I, at that moment, recognized that if I stopped telling the story, it couldn't continue. And I had to ask myself, you're free to be a masochist, but that's not what I wanted. That's not how I wanted to spend my leisure time or my free time. And that's when my spiritual search really began.
Your spiritual search ended with Papaji. So how did those things shift?
Well,
after that,
you get better. You get where you get more aware. You recognize things. You practice mindfulness. You have a mantra. You do all these things. But still, I was identified with the person in the story. And so, if I didn't practice or if I did mess up in some way, it was always waiting to grab me by the throat. So when Papaji said, just stop, or simply stop, and I heard that is stop telling the story, I recognized the story really had nothing to do with the truth of who I am. It is something that had been built over, when I met Papaji, I was 48 years old. So from the time of my birth, or maybe in the womb, or maybe before that, just genetically, something that was built around consciousness, but really just like a name. It's useful in certain contexts, but it's not the truth.
I have done, I would say, a sufficient amount of therapy in my day. Mm-hmm. And what strikes me is that I would tell the same traumatic, dramatic stories over and over again, and it would evoke that horrible feeling of shame. And maybe I got braver about telling the stories, but the feeling of shame didn't change. It would just be like, oh, here you are again. And I think that that moment of actually meeting it truly was the only source of liberation for me.
That's right. Because it is, let's say it's necessary to speak it, to be able to see it, because in that you have the opportunity, at least the next time it appears, to recognize it. But finally it is opening to, because the shame, the feeling, because you feel it physically, you feel it emotionally, it's linked to the story, but it's what embodies the story. So then to meet that, you see it has no substance. Yeah, that's a liberation. It's not like you get liberated from it. It's actually liberated from you.
I definitely think there's huge value in telling somebody a story that feels painful and shameful, because if you're talking to the right person and they're not reflecting back, oh my God, that could, like, you're a terrible person. If they're reflecting back this just unconditional love, there definitely is healing in that, just to see even how that could possibly work. But then to transfer that to the inside, yes, in the form of self-love, is a whole different level of what we would call healing.
Yes. Yes, I agree.
And yet, at the same time, as I think about these experiences, or when I think about just even doing this topic with you, this conversation with you is quite different than one would have with a psychotherapist, for example, because this conversation is not about healing shame.
That's right. Yes, that's right. It's not about fixing shame or fixing you and your shame. It's about opening to whatever is here, inquiring directly. That's right.
You know, we had that show with Janine Roth, which was great, about eating disorders and the shame that can come with eating disorders, the shame that comes with addiction, the shame of doing someone wrong. When somebody comes to you with a world of that, you're not a therapist, but what do you do with that?
Well, you know what I do with it. I mean, it's what you got from reading the book. I really invite you to open to the experience rather than to continue to follow loop after loop after loop, endless loops of the story, to stop your unnecessary suffering. And to be aware of the grace that is revealed in that moment as always present. Because there are other moments that can, let's assume they will, skillfully assume that they will appear in the future, where you could be set up by your own actions to generate harm to someone. If you're willing to actually open to the infinite possibilities of what's here, you can actually meet any situation as yourself, as that openness. And in that, take responsibility for every situation, meaning taking responsibility for your own suffering. You can grow up. That's what I tell people. Grow up.
I posted this topic on the Gongji Radio Facebook team page, and I love to get the feedback from other people because, you know, I have my own take on things, and I like to hear other people's take on things, particularly for this type of conversation. So some of the comments had to do with addiction, and some of them had to do with the kind of that self-perpetuating shame. But somebody also made the point that shame actually maybe can't exist without the thought of what I think other people are going to think of me. Because then who cares, right?
Although we often see ourselves as another person. We are just one of the people. You know, who are you if you don't have an image of yourself and who you should be and what you're better than? That's what I meant by the internalization. Yes, it takes other people to generate the habit and to learn how to be that other person. But I think we do learn that.
Such a great point, you know, that we all have all these people inside us saying all sorts of things at any given moment. And then we feel sad or angry. Or
it's madness, isn't it?
It totally is.
Yes, voices in your head. Great power from these voices. But it's like the Wizard of Oz, you know, you have to be willing to expose the magic trick, because it's a miraculous magic trick that we can have these images and voices in our head. It's just stupendous. But when it generates unnecessary suffering, it has to come an end to it, and that's simply being still.
To finish this, I just want to ask you one question. Is shame even an issue for you in your life now?
No. That's not to say I don't have regrets, but I really make a distinction between regrets. I think from regrets we can actually learn, but I don't believe that we actually learn from the shame. I think shame, because it's so unnecessary in its suffering. Regret, you can go, sorry that happened. Sorry I did that. But shame is, oh my God, I did that. I'm horrible. I'm no good. So it's you know, who knows when I walk out of the door, but we all have the capacity to discover what are we telling ourselves. What is this particular voice that bears my face and my name telling me about who I am? And so that's the way our minds work. But we don't have to believe any of it. And we can stop it. That's the main thing. That's what I learned when I was in my 30s, in that moment of recognizing that I was perpetuating the torture. In that then, I was in my own body perpetuating it, but that meant I was also perpetuating it in the whole cosmos. And we have the opportunity to really ask and answer the question, what do I want?
Like the fear of death or non-existence, the self-hatred is it's a horrific gift, and it seems to come with most humans who were raised by most parents. Just gets inbred in there. Bad girl, wicked girl, stupid girl, mean girl, selfish girl. And it's like, oh, it's right, you have the proof of all of that. And so the trust, when you trust yourself, is actually willing to penetrate that to discover what's underneath it. And the byproduct of that penetration is the liberation of this wicked, bad, ugly, filthy little girl. Bad seed. Throwback. However we formulated it, and whatever support we've gotten for that formulation, that's what gets liberated. And the trust is still opening to what's underneath that. But to get underneath it, there has to be a penetration of what the barrier is, the disbelief, the fear, the self-hatred. With all of our proof of how that is so. So I've shared with people before, finally, I didn't see myself as an image. I just saw dark, murky energy. And I had already met sort of the frantic, hysterical, crazy energy. This was under that. And the frantic, hysterical energy was an attempt to escape this dark, murky stuff. And it's like, oh my God, not that. But here it was. And for much of my life, I had spent avoiding it, circling it, dramatizing it, fixing it, hating it. And I just opened, as I invite you to open to it. I experienced it. And it felt like it moved through my body, like it was maybe a curse. So let's say we've all been cursed, and you could feel this demonic curse moving through, and then it was gone.
If you'd like to listen to that entire clip of Gangaji, it's from a YouTube called Gangaji on Self-Hatred. The whole thing is about 8 minutes long. If you Google it, it should pop right up. It's a great, great clip. Someone recently asked me the best way to support Gangaji Radio, and there are two ways. Well, actually, there's three. First, if you are listening via iTunes and you'd be willing to take a moment and give us a rating or write a comment, that helps people find Gangaji more easily. Also, if you'd like to find out more about supporting A Conversation with Gangaji and Gangaji Radio by making a donation. The address to write is gangajiradio@gangaji.org. And finally, if you like this episode, please pass it along to a friend. The title of next month's show is The Courage to Give Up Hope. Hope seems like a good thing, so why would anyone ever consider giving it up? Way back during our very first episode on chronic pain, Gangaji said this, "Hope is very beautiful, and then it becomes a poison." We're going to talk about what that really means next month. Okay, that's it. I'm Hillary Larson. Thank you for being here. See you next time.